You're listening to Hearing Our Heritage, the podcast where we preserve the voices and stories of the older generation and make them accessible to younger ears. We pay tribute to those who have paved the way and learn from their lived experiences. I'm your host, Katie Pierce.
My name is Marjean Lois Robbins Kohler. I was born April the 15th, 1930 at the D Hospital in Ogden, Utah.
Jean Kohler has had an amazing life full of adventure. She is an avid family historian with many fascinating stories from her heritage. She worked as a school teacher for many years before marrying her husband, Frank. Together, they raised two children while moving all over the world. She is a positive, bright woman who has been close with the Lord her entire life.
I was the second child born to Katie Helen Johnson Robbins and Joseph Edward Robbins. I had an older brother, Lamar, who was born in 1926. There was another son born in 1928, and he was born dead and is buried in Snowville, Utah. My parents were first-generation Americans. My mother was born in Millville, Utah, to Nils Johnson Norblad and Edvig Carolina Vinborg. And she was the first daughter born to them. They were both Swedish, and she had a younger brother named Nils Johnson. There were so many Johnsons in the Swedish army that they gave them surnames, and his name was Norblad. Well, my grandfather was married to Anna in Sweden, and the missionaries came. They lived around a Momo house in Sweden. And the missionaries came, and they were converted to the gospel. And his wife wanted so to come to America, to come join the saints, because things were hard in Sweden. They had two sons, and she had one daughter. And if they went to school, the priest came and tested the children every year. And if they weren't learning the catechism, the mother wound up in jail. So she wanted to get out of Sweden and come to America. And my grandfather wanted her to stay a little longer so he would have a good pension from the Swedish army. But they gave that up, and they came in 1891. They arrived in Millville. And my grandfather worked at the mill for 25 cents a day. And his wife died, and he had two sons. Well, my grandmother came with her mother in about the same time, in 1891, from Sweden, from the same area. And my grandmother, Hedvig, had never been married. And so we theorized that the bishops thought, oh, here is poor Nils with his two boys and his older daughter and no wife to help him. And here's Hedvig living with her mother and never been married. And so we theorized that he suggested they get married. And so they were married in the Logan Temple. And going through the temple records, I discover that before they were married, they did the work for his dead wife, and they did the sealing. So he sealed to both of his wives. And my mother did tell me this story, that when she went to school for the first time, she was six, and she spoke only Swedish, and all of the kids laughed at her because she didn't know any English. Swedish was spoken in the home. So she got busy and learned English. When she graduated from the eighth grade, she had the highest grades in 6 schools, and she won a scholarship to go on to a BYU academy. But her father did not want her to leave, so he convinced her to stay at home and be with him a year. And he saw that wasn't what she wanted. So the next year, she went to school and she learned how to become a stenographer. And she was one of the best. She used Greg shorthand, and everybody wanted to hire her. And she worked, and then her mother died in Provo at the mental hospital. And I did not know till after my mother had passed away that my mother, her father, had to commit her mother to the mental hospital. But my grandmother had diabetes, and there was no help for a person with diabetes. And she just lost it. She was there for a year, and she died of the shock treatment. She died in 1917, and my grandfather died of the flu in 1919. So my mother was free, and her brother was married and living in Ogden and invited her to come to Ogden to live with him and look for a job. So she did, and she left, and that's where she met my father. My father was one of 10 children, but 9 lived. His father, Cyrus, was 4 years old when he left England with his parents. His father came first to earn some money and died in St. Louis. I found that they applied for help from the church. There were 6 of them. He had 2 older brothers, James, Joseph, and an older sister, Mary. And their grandmother, Mary Ann Campbell Robbins, who was 94 when they came. And being in an immigration company that had to borrow money, you were the last company to leave. So their cousins came the same year, but they got to leave earlier because they could pay their own way. But my family came later, and they didn't make it to Salt Lake till October of the year. And the following April, my grandfather's mother, Nancy Ann, died of breast cancer. So he was more or less an orphan. His older brother, James, was supposed to take care of him. And James was lazy. He did not like going up and digging for the granite to haul for the Salt Lake Temple. He wanted to go back to St. Louis. So he took my grandfather, put him on a wagon to go back alone with another company that was leaving. And my grandfather somehow or other got off the wagon and got lost. And some woman in Willard found him and took him in. And he heard her telling her husband that they should adopt him. And that frightened him. So he ran away. And somehow or other, he got up in Mantaway Canyon. He was up there for 2 days alone without any water or anything to eat. And Peter Mann and Azel Riggs were coming from Wellsville down to Brigham City. And as they were driving along the canyon, they saw this movement and they thought it was a wild animal and they were going to shoot. And then the one had his binoculars and said, "Oh, that's a child. Don't shoot." And when they found Cyrus, he was in bad condition. But they gave him water and food and they took him back to Wellsville. And no one knew where he was. And then a cousin went back to St. Louis and helped lead the different companies into Utah. And he happened to take a group up to Wellsville. And lo and behold, he saw his cousin. So they knew where he was. But my grandfather had a hard life. very hard life. My dad tells me when the prophet was coming to speak in the Perry Tabernacle, he wanted Saul to go, but he had no shoes, so he used boot blacking and painted his feet so he would be presentable, so he could go into the tabernacle and listen to the prophet. He was a great man. When I was born, my mother said to my brother, "What should we name your little sister?" He thought for a minute. His best friend was his cousin, Eugene Truceder, and his name was Lamar. So he said, "Jean Mar." And mother said, "Oh, why don't we turn that around and call her Margene?" And he said, "Oh, that's good." So I always thought that my name was original. It was original for us, but it wasn't original because I have met other Margenes. But that's how I got my name. I grew up in Ogden, and I went to the Lorne Farr School, and I lived on 22nd Street. At first, we lived on Jackson and 22nd, and we lived in the 13th Ward. And that was a wonderful ward, and that was where I was baptized. My older brother, every time my mother went away, he'd get us sitting up there on this shed. When I was 5, I got a bike, a little two-wheeler for Christmas. And my uncle taught me how to ride it. He walked along the side until I could do it, because you didn't have training wheels. And that was fun. I lived on that bike. Then my mother so appreciated me helping that one summer she brought me this beautiful bicycle, big bicycle. And as soon as she came home, I could go. And I did. I rode all over town on that bike. And then I had a sister named Marilyn. She was 2 years younger. And Joanne, she was a year younger than Marilyn. And then Wayne came 4 years after Joanne. Mother, when she had Marilyn, went into convulsions. During the 6 month, the doctor said she could not live and have that baby, but she wanted to. And the doctor told my dad, "You have to choose. I can't save both of them." He said, "You save my wife." But Marilyn refused to die. She lived. And mother said she was like a little star bird. She still had webbing in between her fingers. She was born at 6 months, and she had a rough go of it. And her childhood was one that was hard, too. She was sick all the time, and we all remember growing up. We had all these measles, mumps, all these diseases, whooping cough, chicken pox, and they'd come and put a sign on your door. And you could not go out. If anybody came in your house, they couldn't leave. So my dad worked out on the road for the railroad. He came in on Saturday, and he couldn't stay with us. He'd have to go stay with his sister. And I remember that so well. And when you have 5 people in your family, you can spend a lot of time in quarantine. And then I remember that my sister Marilyn was really sick one time, and the doctor came to spend the time with her, and he stayed until midnight. Then he left to go home, and he said he'd be back the next morning. And my mother spent her night on her knees by that bed. And when he came back the next morning, Marilyn was still alive. And Marilyn told her children, that night, every time she opened her eyes, she saw her mother kneeling by her bed praying. My mother believed very strongly in the Heavenly Father. So when she was pregnant with my little brother Wayne, the doctor told her that there was no way she could live and have that baby. And several doctors examined her and said the same thing. They said that she needed to have that baby aborted or she would die. Well, she went home and told my dad, and my dad asked her, what did she want to do? And she said, I want to go to the temple. So he said, well, then that's what we'll do. So on June the 7th, 1937, we went to the temple. I remember we stayed with my Aunt Bertie in Salt Lake, and my mother and father spent one day in the temple doing endowments. And then the next day, she took us to the temple. And I remember it was the Salt Lake Temple, and we had to stay in the basement. It was really cold, and we just sat on a bench and waited. And they dressed us in white. And then they came and got us, and we had to walk up the stairs. And we walked in, and we saw our parents there. We were so happy to see them. And I remember we all knelt around the altar and put our hands on our mother and father's hands, and we were all united as a family. And then a woman took my two sisters and I down back to the basement, but Lamar stayed there. Because my father was married and they lost a son and she had died. So my mother not only did the work for herself, but for his wife. And I remember that was really a very choice day for me. And then my mother, before she left, the sealer told her. He didn't know anything about her condition, but he promised her that would be her easiest birth. And it was. She had Wayne, and he was healthy, but at his birth, they discovered that he would have been a twin, and the other had died. So I'm assuming that's why she was able to go through that pregnancy without any problems, and he was healthy, and she was healthy. And I always thought that she did that so we could all be together, but as I got older, I realized, no. She did that just in case anything happened. She would always have her family. I had a marvelous experience when I was 8 years old. One of my friends, Doug Daly, was being baptized the same day, so his dad baptized us both. And then they put their hands on your head and gave you the gift of the Holy Ghost. That was in sacrament meeting, and that was very special. But then I remember I went home, and Sister Kemsley, who lived on just two houses down on Eccles Avenue, had come to my sacrament meeting just for me. So Mother wanted me to take a piece of cake to her house. So I did. And she had two steps to her porch. And I went up those two steps and went up and knocked on the door. And she answered, and she was so thrilled to see me. And she was so gracious. And I gave her the cake and she thanked me. And I turned around. And as I stepped down onto the stairs, I felt this pressure in the top of my head, and I felt it come all the way through my body. And that was very special, and I never realized at that point what it was. It took me a few years. And then I thought everyone had that experience. But in checking, I discovered not everyone gets that. But I did, and I lived worthy to have that gift and used it, and it has been a guide all my life. And I'm so grateful for it. My mother always taught us to pray at my mother's knee. And I always did that at night. And I remember one summer she was working. But my two sisters took my brother up the street to play with their neighbors that were the same age. And then one of them came and said, oh, my little brother Wayne had got caught on a limb and it was sticking in his arm. So my brother went up, and it was under his arm. So he had to lift him off and bring him home. And We called Mother, and she had a doctor, and he came up to see Wayne and take care of him. And I remember I felt so bad, and my mother came out on the porch, and she said to me, "Honey, it's not your fault it happened." And I said, "But it was." And I really believed this, because the night before, I was too tired to sit down and say my prayers properly, so I was going to say them in bed, and I fell asleep without saying them. And I just knew that's why he was hurt.
Of course, Jean later learned that she couldn't take blame for the accident, but the story does illustrate how seriously she's taken her relationship with God, even from a young age.
I had a wonderful mutual teacher. We just lived four blocks from our stake center. And she had us all go in and get slips so we could go down and have our patriarchal blessing. We walked the four blocks and we got a patriarchal blessing. And my blessing, it told me I had a gift. One of them was that I should cultivate my voice. And my mother read that, then she made sure that I got voice lessons. So I sang in everything. In fact, I sang before I could talk. And my brother used to complain, "Oh, she doesn't sing anything. She just yawn, yawn." And so my mother sat me down and taught me a song that she knew when she was growing up, Moonlight Bay. And I still remember the words to that song. I graduated from Ogden High in 1948. I always sang in all the music groups. I enjoyed that in high school very much. And then I always went to seminary, 2 years of seminary. Then I graduated and went to Weber College. I got a scholarship to Weber for music. And I also played a cornet. So I was in Ray Mender's marching band. I was marched in every parades, and I had to play for all the football games and basketball games. That's why I don't like football anymore. And I sang in a musical group that he had. We had wonderful experience in that. And then, of course, we had the wonderful music festivals in the church that we sang in the tabernacle every other year. That was so thrilling to sing. And then they had the dance festivals every other year at the University of Utah. And that was always so exciting to dance in the dance festivals. Then I graduated from Weber College. It was only a 2-year school. Then I went on to Utah State. I took the institute classes and majored in education, because when I mentioned that I wanted to major in music and teach music, they told me that was for men. And so I said, okay, then I'll minor in music. And I taught kindergarten so I could teach music to my little kids. And I sang in a musical group at Utah State under Ray Welty. I took voice lessons from him, and I had one of the lead roles in the opera Martha, and that was really fun. I did enjoy that. And I signed a contract to teach in Ogden City Schools, and I taught Lincoln Elementary, which was located out on by 2nd Street in Adams. And I taught there for 3 years. And then there was an opening at Lorne Farm, the school I went to school at. And I applied for it and got it. So I got to teach my last year in Ogden with the teachers that taught me. And they were so thrilled to have me come, because no one else had gone into education. I was the only one that they knew of. So I had the royal treatment, and I loved that. And then a friend of mine contacted me and asked me if I would consider going to South Whittier and teach there, because they need kindergarten teachers. And that sounded very exciting. So a superintendent came to Utah State, and I went up and met with him. He hired me. So I went to South Whittier, taught at Carmenita for 1 year, and then they transferred me to Lake Marie, and I taught there for 3 years. And when I was there, I was state primary music director. Growing up, I've always had to be a chorister, and usually for primary, and I loved that calling. I got a pin once for serving for 25 years in primary. I belong to the Mormon Choir of Southern California for 4 years. We came up and sang for 2 sessions of conference. And my last year there in February, I decided I would go and take out my endowments because I was turning 30. So my mother came down and my aunt went with me. And we went to the Los Angeles Temple. And I took out my endowments. And then I had a friend who went over to the temple once a week to do baptisms, and I went with him, and every week till I left there. There were so many of us, men and women. We had so much fun, all of us. We dated together. We went as a group. Oh, it was fun. We had all these teachers come from BYU, all these people. And we'd take 2 carloads and we'd go down to San Diego and we'd go out every Saturday to the beach and we'd go to concerts. I always prayed and I always went with nice guys, but they were not the one. I just knew. So I was waiting for the right person. And I found him. He was got a master's from BYU, graduated from Utah, and had served a mission in France 2.5 years. I was sitting behind him in a meeting in California there one night, a school meeting, and I looked at the back of his head, and something came through me and told me that he was the one. So I knew. See, he lived in Salt Lake, and I'd come home for the summer, come home for Christmas. He always came up and took me out, and I'll never forget. My roommate and I wanted to know about Granite School District because someone had given us an offer to go to Granite, to Salt Lake, and I thought that sounded good. So I didn't know anything about Granite, so we went and asked my husband. He was teaching at one of the schools, and they had an open house, so we went. And I asked him, is that a good school district? Because he grew up in Salt Lake. And he sent my roommate home. And I went with him to his apartment. And then he started talking to me about going back to Penn State. And I was listening to him, and I thought, is he propositioning me? That's what I thought. And I thought, I can't believe this. And finally he said, would you marry me? I remember I said, well, you know, and people kept telling me he wasn't very faithful. Well, he always went to church. So I said, well, you know, the Lord means a lot to me. He said, it does to me too. Then I said, I'd be honored to marry you. So we got married in August. I just learned that he was very sweet, very hardworking, very intelligent, and very kind, very thoughtful. Never missed a birthday or anything.
One interesting story from Frank and Jean's life is that they were supposed to be married by President Harold B. Lee. He had once been Frank's bishop and gave him a life-saving blessing.
Frank had to go to the hospital. He had gangrene. They wanted to take off his arm, and his mother wouldn't let him until the president Lee came and gave him a blessing, and she couldn't get a hold of him because he was at the President Grant's funeral. So he came to the hospital as soon as the funeral was over, and it was too late. There is no need to cut his arm off. The poison had entered his whole body. So anyway, President Lee gave him a blessing, and his mother told me that Frank told the doctor that he saw all these black streams in red. So they interpreted that they went into all the veins and put tubes in there and put oxygen into his arm. And he was a wonder boy. He was at the hospital. Nobody could go in his room except for the nurses and the doctor. He saved his arm, and when it healed, he had to go and have it broken and reset. So President Lee means a lot to Frank. So he asked him to marry us, and he would have, but he was out of town that day on assignment. So he had a brother, Gailey, marry us. And that's what I remember about the temple. And you couldn't go outside and have your picture taken with your dresses. So we had our picture taken in our clothing on the steps of the Salt Lake Temple. We went to the reception. It was a reception center on 25th and Van Buren, the Mansion House, and it was very nice. We went on a honeymoon on our way back to Pennsylvania. We drove. We kept my car. It was a Ford, and he didn't like Fords, but we kept it. It was the newest one. And we honeymooned on the way back. And I was going to go back and teach, and he was going to go on a border assistantship. And then he had some of the GI Bill left. So we were doing okay. And we went back there, and there was no teaching for me. They had no jobs. So I applied to do substituting, and they never called me. And so I guess it was in February, he said to me, "Do you think we should pay our tithing?" I said, "Well, of course we should pay our tithing." He said, "Well, my GI Bill is going to run out." And I said, "Well, we'll pay our tithing." And you know, in the middle of March, I got a call from Bullsburg. Would I come out and substitute for a week? So I went out and substituted in a third grade class for a week. When the week was over, the principal called me into his office and said, "Would you consider finishing the year for me, because this teacher isn't coming back?" So I took it, and there we had the money to live on.
After about a year, the couple headed to Bruges, Belgium on an assistantship for Frank to continue his studies.
We've had to buy us a car, and he was at school, and we had an apartment above the Duke's, and they were so nice. It was three stories. So I had to go up to the bathroom, and we had two bedrooms up there. And I spent the day cooking, trying to fix meals with what I could buy. And that's hard, too, because I remember going to the bakery or to the grocery store, and I wanted carrots. Carrots. I practiced it all the way. When it was my turn, I said, "I'd like some carrots." Well, and then I went out and walked every day. That's good for me. And I loved it. It was beautiful, beautiful. Bruges is a beautiful city. And people were so nice. That was very enjoyable. We went every Sunday over to Ostende. That was interesting. This man, there was only one man. He was the elder. And all these women. And one young woman had two young children. And we met, he was had a dry cleaning shop, and we met above his business. And it was all in French, and I didn't understand French. But the elder told Frank in French, and he'd tell me what was going on. And that's when I found out I was pregnant. I had to go to a doctor that had been to the United States to learn his trade, had all these books in English, but would not speak to me in English. Only thing he said to me in English was, "It is so," when I thought I either was pregnant or I was dying. And he told me that, "It is so." He always told Frank in French. So Frank knew what was going on. If he remembered, he'd tell me about it. And that was interesting. One little lady that I met in Bruges, with the two children, I thought she spoke French all the time. So the last day we were there, she took me aside. She wanted to ask me a question. She said that, well, in Belgium, the priests, the schools, or Catholic schools. And the priest had told all of the children they should not have anything to do with her children because they were bad, because they did not go to Catholic Church. She said, I don't know what to do. Can you give me some ideas, some suggestions? And I said, well, first of all, that's terrible for a priest to do that. It's teaching you to love the gospel and to know Jesus Christ. And I said, the only thing I could think of, pray. Ask Heavenly Father to help you. He's the one. He will help you. He will not leave you alone. You ask him and he'll help you. And I've always remembered that. I was just shocked. We couldn't fly home. He wanted to stay as long as he could to get all the material. He was writing his dissertation. And we got a job in Colorado. And so we had to come home on the Queen Mary. And we came in May. And it was the roughest crossing they'd had in years. It took them 7 days. And there wasn't a soul on the boat that wasn't seasick. It was terrible. And they had a doctor on board and came and checked me every day. Queen Mary was wonderful, but it was awful because we had one meal. Then Frank could get up and try. Bet he got along better than I did. But I'll never forget that. Then we came back to State College. We had to find a place to live, and we were expecting. We found a place to live for the summer because we'd accepted a job in Greeley, Colorado that fall. So we lived in this apartment and the bedroom upstairs and the kitchen and living room on the first floor. Oh, that was really something. We had a branch there and they helped us very much. So we had our baby there. It was his son. And he was born right on due date, the day before Father's Day. So Frank got to celebrate Father's Day before I had Mother's Day. It was on a Saturday night. I thought, oh boy, I think you better take me to the hospital. So, well, he called the doctor and the doctor said, take her to the hospital. So he took me to the hospital and the girls told him, well, you go home and sleep because it's going to take all night. So I was up walking the floor all night. It was horrible, just horrible. The next morning, he arrived just as they were going to take me into the delivery room. And in those days, nobody got in there with you. And then as I was delivering the baby, I could feel him coming. And they came after me with a gas mask. And I didn't want it. Why should I have it now? But they forced it on me. And of course, I got too much. So they had to wake me up so I could see the baby before they took him away. Oh, and I remember holding that little baby next to me. Oh, that was the most thrilling experience of my life.
Pretty soon, the couple landed a job in Colorado. But this was just stop one in a lifetime of adventure and travel.
We taught in Colorado for 2 years. It was just a 2-year college, and it was, you taught geography for the social studies. We lived in the basement of an apartment, of a house in the basement. We were there 1 week. And the following Saturday morning, the phone rang early. Frank went to answer it. And as he went to answer it, I heard this voice in my head. He's going to be called to the Brisbane. And he came and he said, President Gagan wants us to go over to Cheyenne, because that was the state, to meet with our president there. And he said, you could come with me. So we got the baby dressed, and we drove up there, and I never said a word to my husband, never. But then he went in, and pretty soon came out, and he said, the president would like to speak to you. So I got the baby, and we were walking, and he says, President Gagan has called me to be his counselor. And he said, I can't do that. He said, look at all I've got to do. I can't do that. And I said, honey, you have to. I promised the Lord if he'd help us find a place close to our parents that I would do anything he asked me to do. He's not asking me to do anything. He's asking you. So he accepted that assignment. And that was hard because he had all these new preparations and he was working on his dissertation, trying to get it done. And then in the bishopric, every third week, you had to get up every morning and go out and get all these kids and take them in to seminary. You had to have them there by 6 o'clock, and then you take them home. Then you come home and get dressed and go and teach. Then you have all the other things. He managed to do that, let me tell you. And he got his dissertation accepted. He was in the bishopric for the 2 years, so it was in 2 years, besides the year he had in Europe. And at that time, we moved to Moorhead, Minnesota. He accepted a job, and in Moorhead, it was for the geography department. It was a 4-year school. So he went there, and we taught for 2 years, and then they called him as the chairman. So I was chairman of the department for 2 years. And then we wanted another baby, but we couldn't get pregnant. We could only go to the temple every summer when we came to Utah. So the second year we were up there, we went to the temple and we asked the Lord to help us have a baby. Well, when we went home from Salt Lake, I had a miscarriage. And then that following week, I had to go in to see my doctor because he was going to blow out the tubes. So I went and had that done, and then I started bleeding heavily, and I called him. He said, you've had a miscarriage. So within a month, I was pregnant. Now you tell me, the Lord doesn't help us. So we had our little girl. That was just choice. I told my husband, I don't want to work. I'll just go without anything. I'll sacrifice, but I want to be home with my 2 children. I've waited a lifetime for these kids, and I want to be with them. Oh, I just loved them. I had a lot of fun with them. Took them fishing. Never been fishing in my life. Didn't even know how, but we had fun.
Jean shared a few memories from when her kids, Quinn and Robin, were young.
When we went to Moorhead, the lady was taking us around in the car. He was just 2. He said, Mom, is this Moorhead, Minnesota? And she looked at me and she said, how old did you say that kid was? I said, 2. She said, wow. He had a vocabulary. He could talk. And I remember we taught him how to tie his shoe when he was 4. And he had a girlfriend across the street, Karen, and she was so cute. When she was 6, she came running over. She had to share with us. She had learned how to tie her shoes. So we had her sit there and tie her shoes. And that was nice. Quinn just sat there and thought, strange. He was very bright. And Quinn loved to cook, too. When we lived in Fargo, I remember I was going to help him. I was going to make rolls, and he was going to help me. I had this bag of flour, and it was open. It was sitting there. So the phone rang. I had to go answer the phone. He'd emptied the whole sack of flour on the board. I'll never forget that. He said, can we make rolls now, Mom? Yeah, he can make them. And one day, we had 2 cars. Then Quinn came and he said, oh, Mom, come and help us. I said, what's wrong? He said, we got the hole stuck. So I went out there. They were playing fireman, and they had taken the cap off of my car, the gas tank, and put the hose into the gas tank. So thank heavens they hadn't turned on the water. And Robin was very bright too, but she was always so sweet. Never gave me any trouble. Always loved to help. She was Mama's helper.
The next stop in the Kohlers' grand adventure was moving to South Africa.
We left in May of 1975, and we came back in August of 76. I loved it. We lived in housing there in Grahamstown. We went to Cape Town, too, and we went to church in Cape Town, to the ward, and they had a nice ward there. Well, we left South Africa, and we went to Ethiopia. They were having a war in Eritrea, so it was hard to travel. And we went there to see the rock churches, which were up in that area, and we never got up there. We got as far as Mekele, and that was as far as we could go. And that was really scary, because after we'd been in Addis Ababa, we were supposed to go up the coast, and we're going to have two stops. Spend about 5 days. Well, anyway, we went to the airport at Addis Ababa, and there were three planes out there on the tarmac. Well, the first one loads up and takes off. Second one's announced, and we're not on that one, and it takes off. Then the third one is announced, and they load that up, but they won't let us on it. No. And I said, well, when do we go? And they said, maybe tomorrow. Pushed me back. So we didn't know what to do. So we went to our hotel and called our travel agent that was taking care of us there in Addis. And she came right over in confidence. And she told us how bad things were. And then she told us, well, I'm really surprised you got here because you're Americans. And America is telling people to stay home. And I said, well, we came from South Africa. She said, I'll see that you get on the plane tomorrow. So she came and made sure we got on the plane. We went to the next city, got off. And that wasn't too bad. And then we went on the third trip up to Mekele. And they advised us just to stay in our place. And then one guy took pity on us and took us around to show us some of the city, but he wouldn't take us out to where we wanted to go. That was war. And there were all these Russian military people that were in that hotel with us. Then the next day, we went to the airport, and you had to put your luggage on the grass. Plane landed on the grass. And then here all the natives standing around looking. And Robin has blonde hair, and they want to feel her hair, but she has this little Cindy doll, and they've never seen one of those. So I frightened her, but I said, let him touch it. Pass them around. Let them look at it. Hold it. Oh, they were thrilled. So then the plane comes, and we can put our luggage back together again and tell them what's ours, and they put it on. So then we get on and we start taxiing down the grass, and they stop us. And they come on and they make some people get off. And I said to Frank, I'm not getting off. I won't get off. I'm staying here. They brought some military people in. So we took off and we got to Addis Ababa, thank heavens. We went from there to Greece. We went all around Greece. We saw a tour, classical tour of Greece, but my husband had trouble. I won't tell you what his problem was. A lot of people on the tour in Greece had to stop every once in a while because they weren't used. They use a lot of grease on their food, and it really affects people. So anyway, then we went to Vienna, and we got tickets to the Merry Widow. We thought we should take our children to see that. We couldn't sit together, but we saw the Merry Widow. And that was very good. Then we went into Germany to meet the relatives so our kids could meet the relatives. We had a car and we were driving that. And Frank had to have a nap, so I was driving on the Autobahn. And you can go as fast as you want. And the kids kept saying, Mommy, you're going so slow. Why don't you go a little faster? Well, I didn't read their odometer. It reads differently than ours. So anyway, Frank wakes up and he's, "Well, you're going 100 miles an hour." The kids did that to me. So I slowed down. So then we went to England, caught a plane, and we flew into London and rented a camper there. And we spent several days driving around England, showing them things. And then we got on the plane and went to Kansas City, where Margaret and Ken met us. That's Frank's sister. And we stayed with them for a few days, and they put us on the plane, and we went to Salt Lake, and our parents were there, and we spent a week with my folks and a week with his. Then we had to get back to Fresno for the kids to go to school and Frank to start university. Then it was in 81. We left Christmas Day in 80, and we arrived in Sydney, flew into Honolulu, and then from Honolulu to Sydney. That's a long flight. And we arrived there, and someone met us and took us to a house that we had rented. We stayed there for a year. Frank taught there, and well, I stayed at home. And I had a sewing machine so I could sew and try and bake things. But I liked to walk to town. We lived in Chatswood, and I could walk to town. That was good. I got in really good shape there. And Quinn was a freshman at the university, and Robin was in the ninth grade. And she went to a school, and they had to wear dresses, both in South Africa and Australia. They have uniforms. But in South Africa, they're very picky. You have to look nice. But in Australia, they weren't as fussy about anything in Australia. Well, there was a sweet lady next to us. She was from England. She wanted to go back to England. And I took them to the airport. I thought it was sad. No one came to say goodbye to them. I just barely knew them. And I took them to the airport and helped them get on their plane. We went to New Zealand for 2 weeks. We spent Christmas in New Zealand. Then from New Zealand, we went to Fiji. Spent a week in Fiji. Then we flew to Honolulu and spent a few days there. And then we flew home. Then we went back to Fresno.
With Fresno as their home base, they headed next to Hong Kong.
We went to Hong Kong for the summer. We spent 3 months in Hong Kong, and this couple, he was there for the church to go around and take care of the area. And they had a very nice apartment, and so they didn't want to leave it empty. So we wrote to the bishop, and he gave us their names, and they would love to have us come and stay in their apartment. It was on the 13th floor. It was really nice. And we stayed there for 3 months, and we had a lot of fun. We went to Malaysia, Singapore, Kuala Lumpur, and then we came back. Then we went back to Hong Kong the next summer. And all that's fun because that's where they make all the clothing. They have all these good sales. You can go to these companies and buy all these things. That's what Robin and I did. We went shopping. Oh, and they have the golden Buddha that died, that they loved. And he's just sitting there, and they've encased him in gold. It made me sick every time I looked at him, but everybody had to come and see the golden Buddha. The first year we went back, we had a visiting professor from Germany at Fresno State. And we had him for Christmas, dinner, and different things. He came alone. So we had him over at our house a lot. So when we were in Hong Kong the last time, he wrote to Frank and wanted to know if we'd be interested in coming to Munster. He said, nah, he wasn't. I said, what do you mean? you're in German. I think that'd be fascinating. So he said, oh, okay, I'll tell him yes. So we did. And he got an apartment for us in the bedroom. You couldn't stand up because I walked around the town, went to the Aldi and bought groceries because we had a little hot plate. And then we'd go out to eat.
On one of their amazing trips, the couple boarded a cruise in Oslo, Norway, and then caught a train that took them from Finland into Russia.
We got on the ship at Oslo. I was seasick. I had to go down. I missed it all. Frank said it was fun. Then we went up to the top of Norway and got off, and we came down through Finland, and we got on the train. And finally, we found our car was almost towards the back, so we were on the Russian part. And we got on, and people were sitting there in their night clothes. And Frank said, there's something wrong here. So when the guy came by to get our ticket, he talked to him. He talked to him for a long time. He talked to him in German. And finally, he went up and disappeared. Pretty soon he came. He said, yeah, we had to get our things. We had to carry our luggage. And we had to jump from one train to the other train. It never stopped. You had to jump over the coupling, I tell you, all the way to the front. And we couldn't get in a car together. I was in with two Russian kids, and Frank was in with a concert pianist from Holland. And he was with him, so he could converse with him. But I was with these two Russian kids that were going to Paris, and they were going to give me the top bunk. And said, nish, nish, give me the bottom. You get up there. So the next morning, as soon as I could, I got up and got dressed and I thanked them. And I tried to give them some rubles and they wouldn't want it. They wanted to get rid of the rubles. And then we had to stop at the border and go up on the hoist so they could change our wheels. So that took a good hour. And then we could get on, and we got off at Warsaw. We went to Schindler's List concentration camp. Oh, that's horrible. Made my stomach turn. East Germany was Russian, and they'd been under Russia, and the wall just fell before we came. In fact, I got a little piece of the wall. Frank chipped it out for me.
All along, Fresno had been home base, but upon retirement, the couple thought about where they might like to live.
He wanted to move to the coast, and I said, oh, no, I want to go back to Utah. We didn't have our parents, they had our siblings, so he said, well, okay, I don't want to, but I will. Every time he had to do the income tax, he'd complain, because it was cheaper in California. It was in Utah, but we went down to the Family History Center and did research. He did German and I did English. And I got a lot of information. I found that my dad was still to his parents when he was 3 years old, and he never told me this. Frank was working on the German line. His father came from Germany with about 500 names, and then they all worked on him. And he was over that for 10 years. He finished it up himself.
Together, Jean and Frank were called on a service mission for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
That was to the Dry Pack Cannery. And I think they did that because I was the chorister, and I think he didn't know anybody else that could be the chorister. I really think that's why he did it. But anyway, I had to use a calculator. I never used one of those before. But it was interesting. We had members of the church come and fill their supplies, and Frank would have to help get them out. And then we'd have to tally them up. We did that for 18 months.
After an amazing life of seeing the world and raising their kids together, Jean said goodbye to her sweetheart, Frank. She shared some of the tender experiences she had surrounding his passing.
Well, it just was very peaceful, and I felt the spirit very strong there, and I realized that he was ready to go. But not only that, when he died, there were a lot of people in the room, and he said he was in charge. I'm in charge, madam. And then he said, Mutter. So his mother was there when he died. He had the most, I can't even explain it. I still see it, this beautiful expression on his face. The only way I can explain it is that it was exhilarating. I really think that probably all these people that we've done the work for, just because you've done the work doesn't mean they're going to accept it. You have to teach them. And he loved teaching the gospel. That was his favorite job. And I think that's what he's doing. Ask the Lord to bless him every night. I miss him. I know Frank is with his family. I just know that the gospel is true. And I know if we live it, we can go and where we plan to go. That's why President Nelson tells us to stay on the path. Because if you don't, it's no matter what you do, some people don't make good choices. But if you plan your life and you plan it along the church and you stay close to it, you get where you want to go. I just want my children to know that I know with all my heart the gospel is true. God lives, Jesus is the Christ, and the prophet Joseph Smith was indeed a prophet of God. And I know that if we stay close to the Lord, we'll never be alone. Every time we take our sacrament, we're renewing our covenant and promising that we will keep the covenants we made with him. And that's all we have to do. I don't want to have any empty chairs in heaven. I love every single one of them. And I want us all to be together again, as I know we will be.
As you've heard, Jean is an incredible example of positivity, love, and staying close to God. Her life has been punctuated by incredible experiences and promptings from heaven. She's devoted her life to caring for her family and doing what's right. A huge thank you to Jean for being interviewed and to Robin Smith for making this possible. If there is someone that you would like to have featured on Hearing Our Heritage, email hearingourheritage@gmail.com or visit our website, hearingourheritage.com.